This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, everyone, and welcome to Cobblestones Chronicles yet again. I'm really delighted to be here with you today. And I've got another of Frank Fife's wonderful stories of early days, which he collected in his time living in Great Anne. And he collected them from all over the Wairarapa, so I've still got a few more to go. And I thought, well, it's coming up for Christmas time, which of course would have been a very important celebration in the early days of the Wairarapa. And I thought that I would talk today, I'd use some of the information from this book that I've got, Inside Stories, A History of New Zealand Housewife, 1890 to 1975, by Frances Walsh. So for those of you who are watching on TV, I'm holding it up to the TV at the moment, but it's got a lovely cover with three dishcloths hanging up, and those are the things that we use a lot in the kitchen, don't we? I have a huge drawer full of dishcloths myself because they're awfully handy things, especially to replace plastic often, because you don't always need to use plastic. And I personally hate cling film because I feel it's, you know, it's a bit of a waste of plastic, but there you go. So in the kitchen section of this book, there's a wonderful photograph of a plain white loaf, which is being cut because there's a knife beside it. So it's a whole loaf that you have to cut up. Some apples, what looks like a milkshake glass, you know, one of those tall glasses with a straw in it, a fork, a couple of large red prawns. I don't know whether they're supposed to be crayfish on a plate, and of all things, an ashtray with a burning cigarette in it. So I suppose there were times when people were smoking in the kitchen. Not something that I did myself, but there you go. And the headline for this is Keeping the Tins Full and Getting Dinner on the Table. And I don't know about you, but I've still got tins and I like to have something in them. And it doesn't always last very long because my husband often goes and shakes the tin, hopefully, to see if there's something in there that he can eat in between meals. And his favourite is fruitcake. So if I want to be in his really good books, then I make a fruitcake and pop it in the tin. But that was the thing, wasn't it? And I got that from my mother and my grandmother and my great aunt and my other aunties, because they always had tins full, and if you just popped in to see them, then you were more or less insured of at least a biscuit or two. And in this book it says, much hinged on a woman's ability to put on a tasty, balanced spread. The homemaker must know a good deal about chemistry, because upon the chemistry of foods, some of the great problems of the day depend, Dr. Luther Gullick wrote in 1900 in The White Ribbon, edited by the vegetarian and great suffragette Kate Shepherd. If we grant that intemperance is really due to bad cooking, as many people seem to think, and if we grant that our spiritual lives have more than definite relation to the kind of issues that our bodies are made of, and if we grant that our spiritual devotion is affected to some extent by the activity of our livers, then the study of the chemistry of food becomes of tremendous importance, explained Gullick. He was channeling a thoroughly Victorian view. Back in those prohibitionist days, it was thought that husbands' descent into turpitude was triggered not just by second-rate cooking, but also by the wife who served it to him. Wives often got blamed for things in those days, and still do, but it's interesting that, you know, a wife's bad cooking was the blame of many things. So it resulted in many things. I must ask my husband if, when I go a bit off cooking sometimes, and I've been having a bit of a run at the moment of managing to burn things. So he's had things served up. My mother was particularly good at burning things, and my father used to say, "I'm not a Greek god, dear. I don't need burnt offerings." Oh, dear. Well, why don't we have a little break? And I'm going to play you a song now by a lady called Helen Dorothy. And this one's called Weeping Waters. And I thought that might be quite apt after that. So here we go. Weeping Waters.
Water soft, water clear, rolling river, falling tear, memories of the young and the old. River gold, for high above on a mountain steep, once her emerald lake began to weep. Broken crater, engine steep. Thundering river, broken dreams. Water fresh, water pure, then the cause and now the cure. On this new bridge, folk may have stood, petals falling from the steel and the wood. For high above on a mountain steep, once her emerald lake began to crater, engine steep, thundering river. Is cold, and there's a trace of diesel in the air. And I wonder who those people were who lost their lives there. For high above on a mountain steep. Engine steep, thundering river. broken dream.
That was Weeping Waters by Helen Dorothy. It's a lovely song, and it's actually about, records the Tangawai disaster, which was Christmas 1953. If you get a chance to go and see Helen Dorothy, who's back in New Zealand for a few months, do go. She's a fantastic songwriter, and she's very good at... she's very good at capturing particularly New Zealand scenes and New Zealand music and writing about them. So, to go on with the lovely pieces of information in this book about the kitchen. The book now says that the original message from Dr. Gulick resurfaced in the 1950s advertisement for Hansel's cloudy flavouring essences. That ad said, "Kissing alone doesn't make happy marriages. Personal charm plus umph may be very desirable attributes, but there's the practical side of marriage that plays an equally important role in assuring a married life. That practical side of the housekeeping side, the cooking. What woman wanted to be responsible for the creation of a boozing spiritual pygmy who, worse still, was displeased with married life? Beside Hansel's, other assistance was at hand. The Edmunds Sure to Rise cookery book was published in 1907. From the 1930s to the 1960s, Aunt Daisy read a swag of recipes out over ZB Radio to a legion of disciples. And from 1933 to her death 30 years later, she published a dozen cookbooks in which appeared recipes for such things as Colonial Goose, Nurahoe Snow, Brian O'Brien's Bran Biscuits. And I guess you had to be stone cold sober and not having been at the cooking sherry to say that. Celestial Peaches, which was Chinese. Maori Kisses, which were eggless. Richmond Maids of Honour, Stuffed Monkeys, and Pukahoe Stewed. I don't know if I want to try that. So, it was interesting to be able to read this. And there's a lovely picture of from the University of Otago's a certificate, a special courses for the higher education of women for home science and domestic arts from 1911. I'm holding it up to the camera for those of you watching on TV at the moment. But I just thought, goodness, you know, a whole thing. I was one of those clever children, and I didn't get to do domestic science at school. I got to do Latin and French instead, and I'm not sure whether I actually felt quite good about that, because one of the things about domestic science was that you often cook something and got to eat it afterwards. But there you go. And I have to say that my grandmother and my great-aunt made sure that I could cook things. My mum was not such a good cook and actually wasn't that interested. So I just thought, oh, that's, yeah, okay. Now, I'm going to I'm going to play another song now, and this is called A Circular Bend, which is about the Rorimu Spiral. And if you've ever been from Wellington to Auckland on the train, you go up this wonderful spiral, which is a great feat of engineering to get you from a low-lying piece up into the mountains and then, of course, back down again when you're coming the other way. And I've done this a few times now, and I just love doing it because you can see the back of the train from the front and the front of the train from the back. So here we go, the circular bend.
Used to like flying, to take me on a high, bursting through the atmosphere with the storm clouds drifting by. A lightning crack could take me back to earth, and I know why I have this way to fly. Sailing on the ocean to get somewhere new, I'd find me in a lumpy swell, and there was not much I could do except hold on tight, white knuckle fright, and I'd be thinking about you as we go down, down into the blue. Here we go now, round and round and round, round the bend, waiting to get back on track again. Survive. I've got sweaty palms and twitchy feet and a will to stay alive. But I've lost the will to drive. If I have the option, then I'd rather go by track. But the Eurostar in winter might be hard for me to hack. And crossing a river canyon, well, I'd have to just sit back. Here we go now, round and round and round, round the bend, waiting to get back on track again. And it's anyone's guess when the spiral will end. And to them, I'll keep on heading. Thank you. And it's anyone's guess when the spiral will end. Until then, I'll keep on heading round the circular bend. Round and round and round. Round the bend.
Round and round the Rorimu spiral. It's such a joy to be able to do that. Now, I thought, as we're coming up for Christmas time again, first of all, I want to mention that Cobblestones will be having its annual Carols at Cobblestones on the 14th of December, immediately after the Christmas parade. So come along to Cobblestones on the 14th of December. There'll be lots and lots of music, carols, song sheets, so you can join in with the carols. It'll be great fun. So I'm looking forward to seeing you all there, and make sure you come and say hello. Just ask anybody, what does Jeanette look like? Or you might even hear me talking, and then that's always a dead giveaway. I was talking to my hairdresser yesterday and I was laughing. I was saying my accent is not a New Zealand accent, but neither is it a Scottish one anymore. It's somewhere in between, so a bit of both, via London of course too. So anyway, back to Frank Fife. So this interview that I'm going to play you is about a typical prank that happened. The engine was the Jubilee was stolen, and I just thought it's such a great story that you would enjoy listening to it. And I really want to say thank you to Terry and Eichen for making sure that I had these stories, these interviews to play you. So I'm just going to play them, start playing it now. It's about the night we stole the Jubilee.
I'd like to go back almost exactly 100 years ago. This is a story from Masterton from 1886, 87, 88, 89. A period when New Zealand was suffering badly from a series of catastrophic bushfires. There'd been a long drought. There'd been a winter drought followed by a summer drought followed by There'd been a series of droughts. And over the summer of 85, 86, most of the countryside had actually burned. Wellington lost whole blocks in a series of fires, and predominantly wooden architecture. The result was inevitable. What a lot of towns, cities did was start fire brigades as a result of this dreadful summer of 85-86. And this is what happened in Masterton. They decided that they had a small volunteer fire brigade, and they decided that they'd better formalise this, because that summer the town had been surrounded by bushfires. They'd lost half of one block of wooden buildings in the main street of town, and as a result the volunteer fire brigade had formed. In fact, they called a public meeting, and they subscribed a bucket full of money. And 60 men put up their hands that they would become the volunteer fire brigade. And do you know the first thing they brought? They didn't buy a fire engine. They didn't buy a force pump. They didn't buy a series of ladders. What they bought was 50 second-hand brass helmets from Wellington. And with the overflow, with the residual money from the bucket full of money that had been subscribed, they bought some red blanketing, and they made that into jackets. And they didn't have a fire engine, but they turned out the fires resplendent in these lovely red jackets and gleaming brass helmets. Well, the local insurance companies subscribe some money, and the Masterton Borough Council decided that the thing to do would be to form a regular municipal fire brigade and import one of the very, very latest new technological masterpieces in firefighting. And so they ordered a London Vertical Steam Fire Engine No. 1 at a cost of £300. And they debated whether or not, how they were going to pay this off. And they decided that they could pay it off over 10 years. And so it duly arrived. And it was escorted into town with a torchlight procession. And the mayor's wife, Mrs. Castleberg, broke a bottle of champagne over its front wheel and christened it the Jubilee Fire Engine, because it was 1887 and it was Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee year. Well, the Jubilee was an instant success. The next day, crowds gathered to see it being put through its paces. The fire bell sounded at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and oohs and ahs as the fire doors opened, and out came the Jubilee fire engine, smoke belching, drawn by two horses, almost at the gallop. And they did a big circle in front of the post office, and they ran out the hoses, and the crowd gasped as it shot a jet of water right clear over the church steeple, then the highest structure in the town. Ah, fires just didn't stand a chance. That is, until the first fire. The first fire, what happened was something like this. The fire bell rang, and the Jubilee was manned, and out it went. The fire was about a block and a half away from the fire station. And the Jubilee arrived at the fire. It was just a small cottage, and it was well alight by the time the fire brigade and the Jubilee steam engine arrived. And they waited. Why they were waiting was that it took 7 minutes for the Jubilee steam fire engine to get up steam sufficient to pump any water. The house burned down in 4 minutes. 3 minutes after the house was burned down, the Jubilee could pump water and douse the ashes. Well, next week's meeting of the Fire Brigade Committee discussed this in great detail, and what they decided to do was to resurrect the volunteer fire brigade that should fill in when necessary. Well, the volunteers, of course, had been paid by the insurance companies. They were paid on a bonus system, and every man who manned the pumps was paid 5 shillings for the job, and so there was never any shortage of getting people to man the little Merriweather hand engine. And thereafter, when the fire bell tolled, 2 fire brigades turned out. The volunteers would rush with their little hand engine, and the Jubilee steam fire engine would come barreling out, belching smoke, and they'd wait till they could get up steam. 9 times out of 10, the volunteers had hand-pumped the fire out, were packing up their gear, and on their way home by the time the Jubilee could actually pump. The Fire Brigade Committee again met and discussed this rather difficult situation. And they decided that they'd best try and reduce the steam-up time. Now, the steam fire engine custodian, one Zephaniah Mark Hoare, had his steam engineer's ticket, and he decided, well, if he shortened this tube and he lengthened this tube and he cut down the thickness of this metal, he could reduce the steam-up time. And they gave him permission to do exactly that, and he did reduce the steam-up time from 7 minutes down to 6. The very next fire, 2 fire brigades turned out. The Jubilee waited to get up steam. The volunteers had the fire out and were spending their bonus on the way home. the fire brigade committee decided that still something had to be done. They couldn't quite decide what. And the very next fire, the two fire brigades turned out. A crowd had gathered to watch the spectacle of the two competing fire brigades racing to put out a fire. When they would get there, they'd lay bets on who actually would put the fire out, whether the steam fire engine would put the fire out, the municipal brigades, the blue-jacketed brigade, or whether the red bellies, the volunteers, would put the fire out. And the bets sometimes amounted to more money than all of the firemen made in a year. One celebrated occasion, both fire engines turned out at the fire, which was only a small cottage fire again. It didn't take long to burn down. The volunteers had left a hose connector behind, and so they couldn't get their little hand engine out to, they couldn't get it to work, and the municipal brigade were waiting for the Jubilee to get steam up to fight the fire, and they wouldn't loan the volunteers the hose connector, so the house burned down, and both brigades stood and watched. Another celebrated occasion, the Jubilee arrived first, only she had to turn around and go back, because charging along the road at breakneck speed, the firebox fell off. A shower of sparks in the road. But of course, Zephaniah Mark Hoare, the steam driver and custodian, steam fire engine driver and custodian, didn't see that. And when he got there, there was no firebox, no steam, so he had to go back. This was a somewhat ludicrous situation that carried on for a considerable time. And then one night, Fire Lieutenant David Pickering was walking late at night, taking the air, and at around about 10 o'clock, he was heading back home, and he happened to pass the engine house, the fire engine house, and he noticed that there wasn't a light on, and the doors were wide open, flapping in the breeze. Now, this could be a potential tragedy, because fanned by rising breezes, fires could get out of control. Where was the Jubilee steam fire engine? He went and he struck a light. Engine house was empty. Custodian Zephaniah Mark Hoare and the Jubilee London vertical steam fire engine number one were not present. Well, he didn't panic. Well, not dead, he didn't panic. Pickering decided that something must have called the fire engine away, and so he would just wait for its return. And he waited. And he waited. And he waited. And finally, around about midnight, he decided that something had gone dreadfully wrong. Masterton was unprotected. The wind was now howling. It was the height of summer. Anything could happen. So he told the fire bell. And the municipal fire brigade turned out, and the volunteer fire brigade turned out, and they all descended on the engine house. Captain Barker, the fire chief, turned up to see what the fuss was about, and decided that they'd better go looking for their steam fire engine in case it had been stolen. And he issued the men with lanterns, and they were to go looking by the light of these lanterns for their gleamy brass steam fire engine. And out they fanned. They didn't find the Jubilee fire engine, because while they were still out, the Jubilee fire engine arrived back home, spattered with mud. What had happened was custodian Zephaniah Mark Hoare was determined to get the steam up time down even further. And so he'd taken the steam fire engine late in the afternoon out to the banks of the Waipua River. He'd shortened a little bit of brass tube here, and he'd cut this, and he'd lengthened that. And he was sure that he'd get the time down. And he pulled up right beside the river, right on the riverbank, to pump water. The inevitable happened. The heavy steam fire engine sank to its axles in the mud. The two horses couldn't pull it out. So Zephaniah Mark Hoare walked into town, borrowed a further two horses, took them back, coupled them up, still couldn't put it out, walked back to town, borrowed two farmers, and four horses and the three men finally, at around about 1 o'clock in the morning, managed to get the Jubilee fire engine out of the mud. Next day, the fire brigade committee of the Masterton Borough Council met in earnest session. Couldn't possibly have a town the size of Masterton unprotected in high winds, high summer. The custodian, Zephaniah Mark Hoare, was charged with unauthorised experimentalising, and he was dismissed instantly. He was paid 3 months' wages, £12 in advance, and he left the Municipal Fire Brigade. And he joined the volunteers, and at every time the fire bell went, out turned the volunteers with their little hand engine, and 9 out of 10 fires they managed to put out. And that's the situation that continued for some time until finally it was resolved by the disbanding of the Volunteer Fire Brigade.
The story of the Jubilee. And I can imagine that in early days, I mean, we have to remember that Frank collected stories which might not necessarily have been completely true. And, you know, the stories get embellished along the way, don't they, sometimes? But if you go to Cobblestones, when you go to Cobblestones, go into the fire engine, the firehouse, because we have a handcart in there, which is would have been very like the one in the story. And we also have a fire engine from 1955. It no longer works, of course, but it's still roadworthy. And we have been known to give rides up and down the high street on high days and holidays with the fire engine, because it's great fun. Because after all, who doesn't want to ride in a fire truck? It's great fun. Okay, so back to getting ready for Christmas. As I said, Cobblestones will be running its annual Carols at Cobblestones on the 14th of December, late in the afternoon. It's I think gates open at 4 o'clock and the music starts about 4:30, and then Santa Claus will arrive and there'll be lots and lots of wonderful music, lots of carols to sing, and it's free to enter. And we do appreciate a koha, because if you give us a koha, it helps us keep Cobblestones running, because 6 heritage listed buildings and 2 acres of beautiful grounds have to be kept up, and it's not cheap. So talking of not cheap, back to the Home Journal. So from the beginning, during the Great Depression, the Women's Weekly had paid a lot of attention to food. Aunt Daisy herself was one of the magazine's stable of writers in the early days. And in its first issue on 8th December 1932, the editor A. Argyll asked, "What do women want?" before answering herself. "Plenty of kitchen hints and cookery recipes. Not only the 8 eggs and pound of butter and chicken and aspic sort of thing, but also many recipes suitable for these lean days. Some women are reluctant to admit that they enjoy a good meal. They're inclined to pretend the only interest they have in the subject is merely from a health point of view. But we know better. All healthy women like good food, although they're often very tired of their own well-known dishes. Very often, of course, they have to feed some man or other, and men really do enjoy something tasty and appetizing. And funny they should say that, because often I look to women's magazines for a new recipe of some sort, or think, I wonder if there's a different take on, you know, something that I do. And then, of course, that new recipe appears once a week for a few weeks until I think, maybe I'll try something else. So back to the kitchen. When Blossom of Christ Church's Gobbet was published in the magazine's Over the Teacups pages, readers might have realised that in goading women to tuck in, Argal had something in common with Il Duce. Signor Mussolini launched an anti-slimming campaign. Acting under official instructions, all newspapers published articles designed to convince Italian women that the era of the thin, straight-line figure had passed and that curves and plumpness were to be the standard of feminine attractiveness. Isn't it amazing how men in positions of power can decide the way women should look? Just ridiculous. The word was passed around that the too thin figure was to be known as the crisis woman and that she must give place to the prosperity woman. Okay. Fashion artists were told there were to be no more drawings of slim figures. The idea behind the campaign is eugenic. For the thin, anemic woman, it is contended, makes a poor mother and bears weak children. Well, that's, of course, nonsense. The Women's Institute's Home and Country also fully grasp the value of food, well presented and plenty of it, in encouraging a fellow to ricochet back home. The journal had a poet who had made the following programme. A perfect day. Today I made some raspberry jam, 6 pots of it all told. I picked some larkspurs for the blue, some sunflowers for the gold. I filled big bowls with jaunty blooms and set their beauty in our rooms. I made 2 beds, I swept the floors, I sang a merry song. I darned 4 pairs of socks today, it didn't take me long. I took a chair beneath the trees and beat a sponge cake in the breeze. I changed my frock and set my hair, the table's laid for 2. I've iced the cake in readiness, the whole house waits for you. When you come home, dear one, to stay, your kiss will crown a perfect day. Right, okay, so obviously the little woman was waiting at home, but I do think it's quite funny because, of course, these days it's changed a lot. Although, when I met my husband, my now husband, 25 years ago now, he mentioned something about he was wearing a sock which had a hole in the toe, and I said, I could butt down that for you. We'll wash it first though, but I could darn. And he said, can you darn socks? I said, yes, I can. And he said, well, you are a treasure, maybe I should marry you. I think he was joking at the time, but we did eventually get married about 18 months later. So we're almost at the end of today's show. But I just want to say that on Saturday, it's St. Andrew's Day, Saturday the 30th of November. And Saturday the 30th of November is always a very special day because we should celebrate all things Scottish, because St. Andrew was the patron saint of Scotland. And the reason the saltire, the Scottish flag, has a diagonal cross on it instead of a straight up and down and a cross is because St. Andrew was martyred on a diagonal shaped cross, which would have been uncomfortable, but probably no more uncomfortable than being martyred on the other kind. And St. Andrew is also the patron saint of Greece. So some friends of mine who have some very good Greek friends every year celebrate St. Andrew's Day. So it's always a fun time for us because we go along. A certain amount of haggis gets consumed and a certain amount of whiskey gets consumed. And I thought, because I've been talking about women today, I would celebrate with a Scottish song about in celebration of women. It's by Robert Burns. It's called Green Grow the Rushes O. And it's a lovely song because, of course, Robert Burns was an appreciator of women. And he really enjoyed women as well as being a bit of a lad. And I think he and his wife had something when eventually did get married to Jean Armour. They had something like 10 children. But anyway, I'll play Green Grow the Rushes O and listen to it because it is an appreciation of women.
Stout but caring every hour, every year that passes. Oh, what signifies the wealth of man? 24 the lot says, oh, green grow the rushes, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, the sweetest hours that e'er I spent among the lasses, oh, worldly race may riches chain, and riches still may fly them, oh, but when at last they catch them fast, their hearts can ne'er enjoy them, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, sweetest hours that e'er I spent among the lasses, oh, give me a canny old tale, my arms around my dearie, oh, and worldly cares and worldly men, they all get up so teary, oh, green grows and rushes, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, the sweetest hours that e'er I spent among the lasses, oh, but you're seducious near at us, you're nought but senseless asses, oh, the wisest man the world ever saw, he dearly loved the lasses, oh. Green grows the rushes, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, the sweetest hours that e'er I spent among the lasses, oh, nature swears the lovely dears, noblest work she classes, oh, apprenticed hand she tried on man, then she made the lasses, oh, green grow the rushes, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, the sweetest hours that e'er I spent among the lasses, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, green grows the rushes, oh, sweetest hours that e'er I spent among the lasses, oh.
That was Green Grow the Rushes All by Robert Burns, sung there by Michael McKinnon and Lynn Wilkinson. Wasn't that a lovely song? Well, that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Do come, and if you think of anything that you'd like to know that I think should be covering this programme, send a message into Cobblestone's Facebook page or phone them and tell them, and they'll pass it on to me. Have a good couple of weeks until I'm with you again. Take care. Bye for now.